From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. A stunning exhibit at the Metropolitan Museum of Art features the majestic feathered headdresses, brilliantly beaded clothing, and buffalo hide paintings of the Plains Indians, who for thousands of years roamed America's Great Plains from Texas up through the Dakotas and into Canada. Their art tells a story of dramatic change, upheaval, and adaptation, and of powerful visions of life, their own visions. This hour On Point, the art and story of North America's Plains Indians. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. How do you picture the highest art of the Plains Indians in their shields and pipes, headdresses and regalia? What do you see of their vision of the world? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Little Cheyenne dance music behind us there, chanting. Later in this hour, we'll talk with a contemporary Lakota artist included in the Met exhibit who will join us from a big powwow today in Albuquerque. But first, joining me now from New York is Gaylord Torrance. He's senior curator of American Indian art at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in Kansas City, Missouri, and curator of the current exhibit at the Met, The Plains Indians, Artists of Earth and Sky. It's there through May 10th. The New York Times called it one of the most completely beautiful sights in New York right now. He's also editor of the catalog that accompanies the exhibit, quite something in itself. You can link to a gallery of images from the exhibit at our website, onpointradio.org. Gaylord Torrance, thank you so much for being with us today. It's just great to have you here.
Hi, Tom. It's a pleasure.
This is an astonishing collection. My producer was lucky enough to see it at the Met in New York. I haven't, but I've been through the catalog, and the catalog alone just has me agog. And the story of how this magnificent art came together is sort of amazing in itself, coming to the Met by way of Paris and Kansas City. Tell us that story, Gaylord.
Well, the project had its beginnings with Stéphane Martin, who's the president of Musée de Quai Branly. He came to the United States with the idea of doing an exhibition of Plains art and visiting a number of museums. We met, and he subsequently invited me to curate the exhibition. And I asked at the very beginning if it could come to the Nelson Atkins in Kansas City on the edge of the plains.
Yes.
It seemed important. And he agreed immediately. And almost as soon as that was established, we began discussions with the Metropolitan Museum of Art, who we knew were eager to really bring forward a major collection, a major exhibition of American Indian art.
Maybe I should not have been surprised, but as an American, to think that so much of this has come from collections in Europe, it means that for centuries, I guess, those who hit the plains saw this astonishing artwork and bundled it up and sent it home, painted robes and embroidered slippers and feathered headdresses and all the rest.
You know, first of all, this exhibition really had its foundations in the collections of Musée de Quai Branly. They hold the largest group of Plains Indian objects from the 1700s, you know, 100 years before Lewis and Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been asked many times, how is it that these things returned to France? Later on, they returned, of course, to England, to Germany, other European countries. But in the beginning, the Plains were French America. They established claim in the late 1600s and maintained it until the Louisiana Purchase. So there were missionaries, military personnel, traders, all of these people establishing connections with Plains peoples, diplomatic connections, an active trade, and then sending what were regarded as very exotic and beautiful things back to the court in France for the education of the children's king, or the king's children.
Oh.
And from that point, the collections were dispersed among public museums after the revolution and have subsequently ended with Musée de Quai Branly.
Exotic, beautiful, no doubt. I would also say very moving and in some ways challenging to a standard contemporary American view of the world. There's a different kind of vision of the world here. The area we're talking about, if you picture Louisiana Purchase, of course, the French terrain there, not so different from this. The plains sort of sweeping up out of Texas, which of course had been Spanish with the Apache and Comanche there, and Arkansas, Oklahoma, and then up through Kansas, the Cheyenne country, Dakota, Nebraska, Cheyenne and Omaha. You've got the Lakota up in the Dakotas, Sioux up in that area as well, Dakota in Minnesota, and right on up into Canada, in Saskatchewan, and Blackfeet country all the way up in Alberta. It really is an enormous swath of the center of the country. Remind us of the history of these people. We think of horse-mounted Indians, Native Americans, meeting explorers and settlers as they come across, but it's a much, much older story than that, Gaylord.
It's a much greater story. I suppose the primary objective of this exhibition was to really, really present the great continuum of Plains culture, the long history of these peoples as it's reflected in the diversity and the evolution of their arts. And it is indeed a long history. It begins thousands of years ago with paleo hunter-gatherers. By the time that Coronado came onto the plains in 1540, he encountered Apache peoples along the eastern edge of the Rocky who were living in small teepees and transporting their belongings with dogs. But at the same time, there were also numbers of tribes that were living along the major waterways in the central plains. They'd established earth lodge villages. They were planting crops and going on seasonal buffalo hunts. This is a part of Plains culture that is not so well known. It was really only with the acquisition of the horse, primarily after 1680 and into the early 1700s, that the Plains buffalo horse culture that everyone knows so well really established itself. And it lasted for a brief period of time, really less than 200 years. After 1880, Plains peoples were forced and confined onto reservations. Life began to change in a very, very dramatic way. And, of course, the culture has endured and gone on to the present day. So it's a dramatic history. It's one that is dynamic and filled with change. And this was, I think, one of the things that was important to show in this exhibition, as opposed to the stereotype of Plains peoples that existed in the late 19th century, mid-19th century, and then sort of disappeared.
Gaylord, give us a sense of the range of objects here, art objects as you present them. But in the case of the Plains Indians, very, very often, I would say usually, they also had purpose in life. These were often objects of clothing or implements of war or tools. Also hide paintings and so on. Give us a range. What's on display in these objects?
Well, there's a great diversity of forms that are directly created through painting and sculpture, and then various forms that are extensions of that porcupine quill work, which is present only in North America, the later bead embroidery.
Beads that came from Europe, by
and from Europe, mm-hmm. from Europe, initially from Venice and later Czechoslovakia, mm-hmm. other locations. Mm-hmm. These all came into the plains through traders. But there are also quite a number of sculptural works in the exhibition. And I think this is a surprise to people because those that are familiar with Indian art are far more used to seeing and understanding the great sculptural tradition of the Pacific Northwest coast and the Eskimo.
The totem pole and beyond.
Mm-hmm. Yes, yes. It was a very dynamic part of Plains culture, but these objects were all of small scale because of the life that was led, being essentially nomadic.
Even with the sculpture, and of course there are standalone sculptures, but I suppose part of what you're talking about here are actually at the same time pipes, so the calumet, the stone part of the end of the pipe, not the long pull it through the length of the pipe, but the stone part. Amazing sculptures here of mythological creatures, of buffalo, of human figures, and human and animal interacting. Very, very common in so much of the art here.
All of these things. And this tradition had its beginnings in the woodlands of of North America. The tradition moved west along sometimes with migrating peoples, but certainly the idea of pipes as a sculptural form, primarily because the material allowed for this, but most importantly because pipes and smoking were associated with the deepest aspects of religion and diplomacy. And so the pipes were important objects. There was a great deal of belief that was focused within those forms. And the stems themselves were quite often beautifully ornamented as well.
So often Indian art is put in the realm of craft. But when I look at this collection, it is moving in a way that can only be described as art.
Well, you've mentioned that word moving more than once, and I think it should be said at the outset for anyone going into this exhibition that what they're going to see is art that is deeply spiritual.
I want to come back and look at that spiritual vision, how it intersects today with the life of the Plains Indians. Some dance song behind us here, recorded in 1975 in Skiatook, Oklahoma. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. A little contest song for fancy dancers there, recorded in Skiatook, Oklahoma. We're talking this hour about the art of the Plains Indians, gathered in a spectacular exhibit right now at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, a once-in-a-lifetime collection, maybe quite literally, brought together from across the United States and across Europe, where much of it originated. The curator is with us, Gaylord Torrance. His home is in Kansas at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in Kansas City, Missouri. Today, he's with us on this fabulous exhibit. You can see a gallery of objects from the exhibit right now at the Met at our website, onpointradio.org. Gaylord, I wish you would maybe meticulously describe a few of the pieces that you found most compelling and give us a sense of, you know, what is it that we're in our mind's eye, we're looking at? What does it look like? What does it bring? And what does it evoke?
Well, that's a hard question. And I find every time that I walk through the exhibit, which I've done countless times, everything becomes more complex. It does not settle itself out into five or six extraordinary works. Truly, in this exhibition, through the generosity of our lenders, we have been able to bring together a remarkable group of objects.
Describe anyone you like. You've seen it 1,000 times. Our listeners probably haven't seen it once. We need to describe some of the most compelling objects here and give us a sense of the artistry involved.
Okay. When you walk into the exhibition at the Met, the first object you confront is a pipestone pipe that's reddish in color, kind of white in the front and red in the back, of a standing man. It appears that he's singing. His mouth is opening. He looks forward. It's a tubular pipe. The shaft runs through the center. But this is a small sculpture of a man in ceremonial regalia. At his back, he wears a feathered bustle, which 2,000 years ago was the beginnings of the powwow bustle that you see today.
He has a big holes in his earlobe, sort of like my barista at Starbucks.
Exactly. And a remarkable, an elaborate headdress or coiffure.
Looks Aztec or today this looks Mexican to me, but it's ancient North American plains.
Well, it actually came from Ohio. And I've had people say, why is it in a Plains exhibition? Mm-hmm. And there is a connection with Mesoamerica because agriculture came up out of that area into the Midwest and with it ceremonial concepts. But the reason that it's in the exhibition is that this object from 2,000 years ago in Ohio proclaims two things. First of all, the pipe as an important sculptural form and the use of tobacco as a consecrated vehicle of prayer. Mm-hmm. And both of these elements move onto the plains in subsequent centuries and become very, very important in plains life and culture and in the art.
There are many painted hides in the exhibit, and I wish you'd give us a sense of the sort of, I don't know if mural is the right word. They have kind of a mural sensibility to my eye. Human figures depicted here, sometimes just geometric sort of graphic design, but often human figures. Are these narrative? Are they telling stories?
The robes you reference are robes painted by men, and they do depict accomplishments in war. Often there was more than one artist represented on a single hide. Mm-hmm. But this brings up, I think, an important point, and that is that the creation of art was established traditionally by gender. Men produced certain types of objects. Women produced others. And in the tradition of painting, men produced visionary and narrative figurative robes, mm-hmm. Shirts, imagery. Women produced geometric forms in robes and painted rawhide containers called mm-hmm. parfleche. Mm-hmm. One of the greatest pieces in the exhibition, in my view, is a painted robe done by a woman around 1830 in South Dakota. It was collected by Prince Maximilian on his trip up the Missouri River mm-hmm. in 1833. The artist that accompanied him, Carl Bodmer, painted the woman wearing the robe, actually.
And, this is the forebears.
She likely was the artist.
The forebears. I think I'm looking at this one right now with a sort of a solar sun figure in the in the center?
No. Okay. It's a robe that has, it's called box and border mm-hmm. is the style. And it's the shape of the buffalo robe with a highly abstract kind of border and then a floating box above, a box rectangular form filled with geometric images. And it's understood that this image collectively represents the internal structure, the internal organs of a buffalo.
Wow.
And it was also classically a woman's robe and really simply affirms the relationship of females and buffalo, both of which sustain life.
I'm looking here at a shield from 1850, North Dakota, Arikara artist.
Arikara.
Buffalo. Arikara, excuse me.
Yes.
A shield, circular, with this looks like a shoulder strap, I guess, or for the arm to be held, and a buffalo
yes.
painted on it, which is so evocative. The buffalo has so
yes.
much character staring out at us from this shield. This is not crap. This is art. This artist has a
no.
vision of the meaning, even the spirit of this animal.
Well, actually, you know, an image like this really revealed itself to a man during a vision quest, which was a period of prolonged fasting and prayer. And it was the point of this was to seek a spiritual helper through life, someone that would guide and protect. And when a man was so blessed, often a representation of that spirit helper would be painted on a shield that he would carry into battle. This particular shield that you describe is one of the most intense paintings of this genre that I've ever encountered. And I would say that the paintings are more or less iconic. In other words, they symbolize the spirit helper. But in this case, I believe the artist was really trying to replicate mm-hmm. the experience of that visionary spiritual encounter with that sacred animal. And it is this intensity that I think so animates that painting.
The buffalo stares directly out from the shield in a way you cannot avoid. It appears to he's looking into me as I look at this buffalo. It's just,
yeah.
It is so, so deeply potent in a moving way. Gaylord Torrance is curator of the spectacular exhibit of Plains Indian Art at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York right now. He joins us from New York. And Gaylord, lots of callers for you. Haley in Omaha, Nebraska on the Plains. Haley, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just am so glad that this is finally, like, coming to, or that Native art is finally becoming an actual thing that people look for. I grew up learning about it. I grew up in Western Nebraska, went to school in Sioux City,
yeah.
and now I'm here. And the Joslyn Art Museum here in Omaha actually has a fantastic, fantastic permanent exhibit with all sorts of Plains paintings and Native artifacts. And I'm so glad that people actually get to learn about it and see it in see it as a higher art form, because it is. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Haley. Was there any hesitation, Gaylord, as people looked out at this body of work to say, yes, this belongs in the Met? You've never done it before on this scale, and the Met's been around a while, so has the country.
Well, I think that's you raise a large issue, and it's and I'm going to kind of compress it, but I think this basically goes back to the way that we as a nation began to institutionally collect historical Plains Indian art and Indian art in general. It was collected as ethnography, as material culture, collected at a time when it was believed that these cultures were going to disappear. And there was a rush to acquire everything and then to put these objects on display to illustrate the lives of these cultures. It's taken us a long time, first of all, to understand the relationship of functionality to works that simultaneously express profound beliefs and values. In European art, your Western tradition, painting and sculpture are the highest forms. They are the means of expression of the highest ideals, the greatest beliefs, and textiles, pottery, basketry, that sort of thing, are relegated to the crafts or the decorative arts. And I think that's where the notion of craft begins, and it's carried forward well into the 20th century. Because what's portrayed, I think, initially is that somehow, as a colleague of mine said, this art just sort of bubbled up out of a culture. Well, it didn't occur that way. In Native cultures, as in all cultures, there were inspired artists who, people of tremendous achievement. Mm-hmm. They were recognized within their cultures. They were elevated for their contribution, both men and women. And it's taken us a time to understand that a club or a shield or a robe or a dress, in fact, all of the clothing, which is in – it would be better to call it regalia because it's so layered with meanings, that all of these things really have – they convey – the same sorts of ideas that European painting and sculpture endeavored to do as well. The closest thing would be thinking about European altarpiece from the 1500s.
Yes.
That it was a functional work in terms of really creating a visible means for an audience that were largely illiterate. Native peoples did not have writing, and their stories, their history, so much was preserved and conveyed and passed down through these works of art as well as through dance and song.
I'm looking at a man's shirt, or regalia is a perfect word for this as you describe it. This is a Ogallala Lakota from yeah. South Dakota. That got the familiar shape, then with elaborate blue and white made of tanned leather and horsehair, human hair, glass beads, porcupine quills, long hairs hanging from the sleeves, horsehair, it looks to me. And, I look at this and it is so, it's immediately handsome, then beautiful, and then I have a feeling of admiration bordering on envy. I mean, I want to wear this and be sort of commune with whatever relations they had with their environment that seems so evidently expressed in this regalia.
Yeah. Well, what you're seeing in that shirt, which is a very famous shirt, by the way, because both Red Cloud, the great Oglala chieftain, and American Horse were photographed in that shirt. We don't know who actually owned it. But men that were invested with garments of this kind were recognized as leaders within the communities. They had tremendous responsibility. There was a class of men called shirt wearers among the Lakota. And these were, from the outside, we would call them chiefs. And they held responsibility for the welfare of the people. They were always accomplished warriors at the very basis, but then they had, you know, great abilities of statesmanship and, you know, deepest sort of humanity that was recognized by the people. And these men would be invested, given shirts of the kind that you describe. In the exhibition, the earliest shirt probably dates back to around 1750. There is one from around 1800. Throughout the exhibition, there are certain forms that show up during these different periods, and the evolution of materials becomes visible, but also the continuity of ideas. And certainly this shirt is very – which dates about 1865, 1870. Mm-hmm. It's representative of those same ideas that you see 100 years earlier. But the materials that you mentioned, that's another aspect of Plains art, I think, certain kinds of forms that is remarkable. I mean, we would call it assemblage. But it's the ability of artists, in this case both men and women, to produce a form through such remarkably diverse materials, all beautifully orchestrated, proportioned, carefully and lovingly crafted, I will use that word. But beyond that, the materials have meaning. The designs have meaning.
Give us a sense. I mean, and the women's regalia is equally powerful here, but the idea or the meaning, put some words to that.
Well, let me begin by just noting the shape of the shirt, which if you look at it, you can really see the skins, the original skins of the deer hide from which it's made. Mm-hmm. And that was a very fundamental way of honoring the animals from which these skins come. The shirt is painted as well as beaded. So the bottom is yellow. The top is probably the night sky from the speckling of tiny beads that cover it in addition to the strips.
It's almost a Rothko in these bands of color, these wide bands.
It's remarkable. Yeah, beautifully proportioned, extraordinary color. And the shirt is in amazing condition.
Hi, everybody. Tom here. I'm glad you're joining us for this On Point podcast. Before we get back to the show, I'd like to tell you about another podcast you might enjoy, too, Dear Sugar Radio. Join hosts Cheryl Strayed and Steve Almond as they field questions about love, sex, work, guilt, money, you name it. That's Dear Sugar Radio. You can find it at wbur.org/Dear Sugar or subscribe on iTunes. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Behind me there, William Horncloud singing the Sioux National Anthem and Victory Songs from the 1998 album Traditional Lakota Songs. We're talking in this hour about the art of the Plains Indians, Lakota very much included, gathered in a spectacular exhibit right now through May 10th at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. It's been in Kansas City. It's been in Paris. It's now in New York, kind of once-in-a-lifetime collection of magnificent objects from the Plains Indians, from down Texas, Arkansas, sweeping all the way up into Canada. Gaylord Torrance is with us, curator of the exhibit. He is senior curator of American Indian Art at the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art in Kansas City, Missouri, normally, with us today from New York. And with us right now as well from Albuquerque, New Mexico, is Jody Gillette. She has one of her own works, a very elaborate powwow dance regalia, women's clothing, included in the exhibit, which extends through contemporary artwork of Native Americans. She's Hunkpapa and Oglala Lakota, member of the Standing Rock Sioux tribe in North Dakota, South Dakota. She's a competitive powwow dancer who is right now at the gathering of the nation's powwow in Albuquerque. She also happens to be special assistant to the president for Native American affairs. Jody Gillette in Albuquerque, New Mexico, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom, and it's great to be here.
When do you dance, Jody? Are you dancing later today?
I'm not dancing later today except for with my son. George Gillette is honored as the head boy dancer at the powwow, so I'll be getting dressed and dancing with him later today.
I'm trying to calculate the amount of hand labor that went into this magnificent regalia that you wear when you dance, Jody. Can you describe this for us? For people who haven't seen it, and I should say there are a gallery of images at our website, but can you describe your costume? Seems an inadequate word, but would you be good enough to try to describe that, Jody?
So it's basically a pink beaded buckskin. The top is separate from the skirt. A long time ago, they were one-piece mm-hmm. Garments, and now it's just for ease of storage and portability, they're separated, and currently the contemporary dresses have longer fringe. So there's a yoke and then a skirt and then leggings and moccasins and a belt and a breastplate, and then there's hair ties and I also wear feathers and dance with a shawl.
Long fringe on the, I'm not sure if sleeves or yoke is the right word for this, maybe 2 feet or more long, the breastplate that comes around the neck and then all the way down the front, maybe past your knees. Is it bone or what's the material there?
Well, traditionally it's made out of bone, but the one that's on exhibit is made out of plastic mm-hmm. and the weight of everything and using the dress with the beadwork on it, and then also having a real bone breastplate. Some people do use real bone still, and have a lot of admiration and respect for them because it's heavy, a lot heavier than plastic. And so I use the plastic.
There's a photo in the catalog of you here in full dress. It's just astonishingly beautiful. And I think you've been through this exhibit at the Met. This is the story of your people. How did you respond to what you saw collected here, Jody?
I was taken away with all of the different pieces, mostly because when I walk through it, it just gives me such a sense of pride and actually hope, because for a lot of the things that I do, there's a lot of misconceptions about Native peoples, and it still carries through today. But I think that this exhibition is breaking down the ideas that people have about the Plains culture because of the depth of not just the time frame, but also the diversity of peoples that live there. And the idea that when I walked through it with my family, we went a couple of weeks ago, you know, we look at it as you walk through and that's your grandmother's beaded purse. There's a grandmother who's a close relative of mine, Nellie Gates. Archambault is in the exhibition, and she has a beautiful beaded purse. That's where she's our relative from Standing Rock. And then on my Oglala side, Red Cloud is our relative, and the war shirt is in the exhibition, and so I can point to that. But I also, my children are also part of Rikara, and so you see a lot more of the Lakota work as it's sort of like more known and more widely popular. But it was really neat where the hides and the different pieces from their father's side, and he's a Rikara and Hidatsa.
The drums and shields.
That was pretty stunning.
Yeah, bear claw necklace, the fans, the amazing regalia costume and pouches and beadwork that's just astounding. The headdresses, both the big bonnet style and much more kind of minimalist headdresses as well. I looked at these pieces. They're so graphically astonishing. They're so compelling. I wanted to see the world through the eyes of these artists, and yet, it's not necessarily open to me. Maybe it is to you. I mean, you're of a people who live in the world right alongside me and everybody else, a very contemporary world, but there's another sensibility here as well. Help us, if you can, Jody, see the world through the eyes of these artists. What's the change of lens that we might put on to take their artistic vision somehow into our own observation?
So I think that it is really important to see what Gaylor touched upon a bit as this is art that's spiritual in a sense, because there's movement associated with almost all the objects. And we had a discussion, Dana Claxton and Edgar Heap of Birds led a discussion about the different pieces. And what we had talked about was how the art is all associated with movement. And so it's wearing clothing and dancing, and it's not just art for art's sake, but there is the utilitarian part of it. And so when I put on my dress, it's just not about a beautiful design. It's also about a lot of action associated with that. It's the dancing. When I look at my dress, I'm thinking about singing, and it's meant to move. It's meant to do something. So it's not just a piece of art that is in an enclosed plastic box, but it's a part of my humanity. And there's also a way of acting when I put my dress on and dance, and that was taught to me by my grandparents, my grandmothers especially. And when I look at the other pieces of art from long ago, there is that connection of, you know, what was going to the shields. They were elaborately decorated, but they're protecting. They are they're moving through the different landscapes, and they are being used to protect life. And so there's a lot of I guess, when you think about the art, there's movement in it, and there's also action. That, yes. And my uncle used to say it really well. He'd say that we're not just human beings; we're human doings.
And I mean, we see it again and again in a bow case and quiver and right on down. I mean, Gaylord, in Western art, as soon as there's a utilitarian side, it gets pushed toward that zone of craft. But here, there's something fundamental to the vision, to the artistry, the spirituality itself, which this engagement with living, with moving, as Jody says, puts at the center.
Yes, very much. And also, I think, and here's what is the strange paradox, is that when one does see this art displayed in a still place, admittedly removed from context, it becomes contemplative to so many people. Something that has struck me in every venue that this exhibition has occurred.
But is that a contradiction? Does that go against the?
No, I think it's. I think of American Indian art from basically all of North America, in many, many ways, as being deeply layered with meanings and different ways that one can associate and relate to it. And I believe that's certainly the way it was in the original culture, and it remains that way today. But what Jody's describing is very true. I mean, my early work was basically in museum storage collections. And it was only when I began to work with a community and began to see some of these objects that I had studied actually used within the context of culture that they took on additional layers of meaning. And then when native peoples were able to explain these things and how they related to them, added more layers of meaning. And I think all of this is really coming together in an exhibition like this. One of the things that we were very dedicated about was bringing forward Native voice as much as we could. So a number of the writers in the catalog are Plains people, some are artists, some are scholars, some are historians. But and then in the didactics as well, the labels, the text panels, there is a Plains perspective from a cultural point of view.
Jody, many of our listeners responding online have tough questions here, you know, asking, should we see these objects, these artworks as plundered? And there's this, in the week when we're a lot of attention being paid to the Armenian genocide, people are very aware of the fate of so much of the Plains Indians community during the westward expansion of the United States. And there's pain here and loss as well as vivid life. How do you put all these things together as you look at this exhibit, Jody?
I really have to be quite honest in how I respond to this, because it is the exhibition raises important questions. I see it as a story that is still being developed, that there's throughout all of these different artworks, there is a fierce desire to continue the life ways of different peoples, and that all of the different, really, you know, the historic aggression against Indian culture as a whole, through the, you know, the policies of removal and Allotment Act, the civilization regulations, those were very deliberate attempts to push American Indians into a different space culturally, and I think that the story that is being told, especially because of the contemporary part of the show, you have T.C. Cannon, you have Rhonda Holy Bear, there's video, there's a lot of different voices that are saying that we're still here, and the artwork that is being produced today, I think, is just extraordinarily magnificent in so many ways. It's not just the utilitarian part of it, but it's also the statement of recent history. It's statements of what some of our grandparents endured, but it's also just a statement that we're here to stay and we're going to continue into the future.
You see in some of these pieces the ghost dance objects, dresses, that time in the late 19th century, desperate longing for all that had been lost, pain as well as beauty and life. And this amazing Red Cloud war bonnet on the cover of the catalog, Gaylord, sort of a head-to-toe nearly eagle feather war bonnet with this brilliant red cloth coming down the side. Mm-hmm. Who is worthy of wearing that? Are American audiences entitled to gaze on that? After all, you know, who was he at war with? It was many of us.
Mm-hmm. That's true. It's part of the history, and it's part of, in my view, it's part of the way that Plains people faced the difficulties that were confronting them. A headdress of that kind was also reflective of intertribal warfare that was occurring before, and there's no denying certainly the difficulty of our history with Native peoples, but there is also, I think, in this exhibition, a celebration of resilience and adaptability and continuation.
And clearly, in its magnificence, it is and has to be honored here. Behind us right now, Sitting Bull's memorial song from the North Dakota group Lakota Thunder and their 2000 album Veterans Songs. Jody Gillette, Special Assistant to the President for Native American Affairs, joining us from the Gathering of the Nations powwow in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Good luck when you do dance there, Jody. I hope it's full of meaning for you and your audience, and we thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
And Gaylord Torrance, curator of the Plains Indians, Artists of Earth and Sky at the Met Theater May 10th. Thank you very much for joining us today, Gaylord.
Thank you for the invitation.
Terrific gallery at our website, onpointradio.org. Thank you for joining us today, listeners. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.